full name, please?
Okay. Oh, Mary Moore Mason, Redfern.
Okay, let's just see if it's... Today is September the 1st, 2009. My name is Isabel Tuning, and I'm in the home of Mary Moore Mason, Redfern, to interview her today for the Brownsburg Museum. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. I've wanted to talk to you for quite some time, and you come very highly recommended by Dick Barnes and others.
Well, thank you. That's probably because of your ability, in that my family has been in this area for a very long time, so obviously we have a fair amount of history behind us.
Could we go into your family history a little bit? I know as a child growing up here in New Providence, every Sunday school class learned about the captive of Abbs Valley, Mary Moore, and she's your direct descendant, and if you could talk a little bit about that, it'd be very interesting.
Well, she was my ancestress, I don't know how many generations back, but we all grew up knowing the Mary Moore story, and it used to be that when we had a family reunion, and the McLaughlins, who also live out here, are cousins of ours, and all these people would get together, and on one occasion, I think there were 10 or 12 ladies all named Mary Moore. And back then, the custom always was that every generation of every family had a Mary Moore, all named after the famous Indian captain. And every so often we would gather out in the New Providence graveyard, where there is a very large, almost like a plinth, to Mary Moore, who was, as she got older, married Samuel Brown, who was the second pastor of New Providence Church. So it's actually a monument to the two of them. Basically, also some of the, I believe the grandfather and grandmother, I'm not absolutely sure of this, are buried on the top of the hill, which is right over there behind us. There's a very, very old graveyard that probably predates the New Providence graveyard, and it's actually on the land that's now owned by Rosa McLaughlin, and in there are some very, very old graves indeed, because Mary Moore returned to this area after the famous incidents for which she's well known, and lived with her, I believe they were her maternal grandparents, in this area. If you want me to go into the story, basically, Captain James Moore married, I'm trying to remember her name, but anyway, Mary Moore's mother, who came from this area, and they moved down into Southwest Virginia, into what is now Tazewell County, which was very much frontier country. And he became quite prosperous because he owned a lot of cattle and a lot of horses, and they lived in a log house, and they had numerous children, and eventually they were warned that this was a dangerous area to be in because of the Indian raids. Now, the Indians didn't live there, but it was a very fertile crossroads for the Shawnee Indians, the Cherokees, and any number of other tribes who came through and regarded it as their hunting land, and they resented the settlers down there. So other settlers had moved away, but Captain Moore decided that he was well fortified enough in his fortified log house, etc. One day the Indians came and tried to steal some of his horses, and the young lad, whose name was James Moore, who was looking after the horses, shooed the horses away, but the Indians captured him. Now that was a totally different story. He was carried off and had many adventures himself, and there was a book written about that which was probably more fictionalized, called Shawnee Autumn. I don't know if it's still in print or not, but he ended up in Canada eventually, where a lot of the Indian captives were taken. Some years after that, Black Hawk, who was the Shawnee chief, and who at this point was quite notorious for his Indian raids, came back into the area. Once again, it was in the autumn. He caught Captain Moore out in the fields with many of the children, particularly the older children, and they were all killed out in the fields as they were running toward the house to try to escape. Mrs. Moore was in the house along with Mary Moore and Mary Moore's older sister, a baby, some younger children, and a visiting girl called Martha Evans. The Indians eventually, there was one serving man who was in the house too, and he tried to fend the Indians off, but he was not well, and eventually he was shot and killed. The Indians threatened to burn down the house. They eventually got in, and they rounded up the entire family and started on a march back into the forest. One of the visiting girl was actually outside and had hidden, but she thought that they had seen her, so she came out from her hiding place and gave herself up. That was Martha Evans. So they all took them up through the forest very quickly, up through Ohio and eventually up into Michigan. But as they took them along, they killed all the younger children along the way. One of the boys was apparently mentally slow. His name was John. He was killed very soon. One of the babies was killed instantly because the younger children slowed them down. And by the time they got somewhere along the route, I think it was up in the forests of Ohio, they divided the captives up into two camps. And I believe there was another Indian tribe, it could have been the Cherokees, I'm not sure, but who were on the other side of a river where they were in camp. And Mary Moore and Martha Evans, who was considerably older, I think Mary Moore was, I meant to look it up in the book today, The Captives of Abbs Valley, to find out exactly what her age was, but she was, I think, either 8 or 10 at the time. Martha Evans was older. Anyway, they would periodically be hidden up in the trees by the squaws because they were afraid the girls would be killed because the Indians would get drunk, and when they got drunk, they could be quite brutal. But the chief, interestingly enough, quite liked Mary Moore, according to all accounts, and it was partly, I think she had red hair, and he found this quite, novel. She also grabbed up the family Bible when they left, and even though the chief did not understand English, he was intrigued at this little girl sitting there reading to him. So anyway, they were kept on one side of the river. Unfortunately, the Indians on the other side did get drunk, and the most brutal part of the story is that they burned her mother and her sister at the stake. So I think, I know Mary Moore was aware of this, and of course she was dealing with, you can imagine, the horror of everything that had happened to both of the girls. So they ended up in around Detroit, Michigan, and which apparently was a great staging point for trade, including human trade, across the border. So they then went across, were both sold to various people across the border, and both the family that Martha Evans was sold into and the old bachelor, who I believe was a Scottish-Canadian bachelor, that Mary Moore was sold to, were very cruel to them. Luckily, Martha Evans then passed on to a very, very kind family who treated her more or less as their daughter. But Mary Moore stayed with this man who treated her, apparently she was kept in rags and had very little to eat and was used as a servant. Well, what they didn't know is by an amazing coincidence, Mary Moore's brother, who'd been kidnapped sometime before, was also up in that general area. Well, Martha Evans' brother, and I think his name was James too, heard about this. He was an older young man. He heard about what had happened. He was horrified. So he set out through the forest to try to find his sister, to find any what had happened to any of these people. And he realized that most of them had probably died, but he thought maybe there's a chance that my sister might exist. And he ran against ran into a notorious Indian trader called Simon Girty, who usually was, in history, is not well regarded, but on this occasion was helpful, and he said, I know what's happened to these girls, and I'll help you. So he eventually ended up, found the girls, had no real problem getting his sister away from this county family, and there is a story that he fell in love with a Canadian girl and wanted to stay, but he felt obligated to bring his sister and Mary Moore back. Meanwhile, he found James Moore, reunited the brother and sister, had a terrible time, getting Mary Moore away from this man. Eventually had to pull all sorts of strings up there, got them back, and all four of them rode on horseback. Of course, she had had to walk. She'd gone on foot all the way to Canada with the remains of the family. They got them all back here, and she was reunited with her, I believe it was her maternal grandmother and grandfather. And she lived, I think, it was at Eastfields. I'm not absolutely sure, but one of the houses in the community here. And when she got to be older, she married Samuel Brown, who was the second pastor, had numerous sons. I'm not sure if she had any daughters, but the sons, when they had children, the first daughter was quite often called after the mother, Mary Moore. One of her sons, who was, I believe, and most of them were pretty prominent guys. A lot of them were ministers, doctors, elders of the Presbyterian Church, whatever. And one of her sons, who I believe was the Reverend James Moore, wrote The Captives of Abbs Valley. And he could never get his mother to give all the details because she was so traumatized by it. When she became quite an elderly lady, she was apparently in considerable pain because I guess arthritis or just, you know, all the trauma she'd gone through. And they had a cradle that they would put her in as an old lady and they'd rock her. And this cradle is in the Lexington, Virginia Historic Society building there, so you can see the cradle. As far as I know, there may well be other books that have been written besides The Captives of Abbs Valley, which is still in print, and it is now sold, but it's available both in the local library here, and also I believe there's a copy in the Brownsburg Museum. And it's, I think it's still in, you know, printed. I believe the version you have there was reprinted in 2002, although it was written back in, I think, 1780-something, because all of this took place, you know, in about that period of time, just after the Revolutionary War. So, anyway, that's the Mary Moore story.
Which of Mary Moore's children are you descended from?
You know, I think it was Daniel, but I'm not absolutely sure. I should know because right here in the book, it has the whole
whole genealogy.
It has all of the genealogy. Now, my mother, who lived to 97 and only died 4 years ago, could probably tell us all of that. But it has here in the back the descendants of each one of the sons and daughters, etc. So I certainly should know that.
Do you know if the family Bible survived that she took with her?
This was one of the great tragedies, is that somewhere along the way she lost it, and she always commented on that because it was the only thing she was able to save from the house. And I also think, and one of the reasons why I would like to go down to Tazewell sometime, is I believe there is a plaque down there near the actual site of the cabin. I would not be at all surprised if there aren't some of the descendants that still live down there. I got that impression from reading one of the books, that there were still people, you know, from the family who'd chosen to move back to Abbs Valley.
Can you explain to me a little how the Moores and the Walkers were connected? She was Mary Moore, but she's connected.
She was Mary Moore. Well, the Walkers, you know, it's embarrassing that I can't really totally clarify this.
It's probably all in the book if I would read the book.
Well, it's quite possible. I mean, the Walkers are another whole story. Most of the people out here, you know, were intermarried.
Oh, I think I may have read that when she came back, she stayed with an aunt who had married a Walker.
Yes, that may well have been the case. Because initially, I believe she stayed with her grandparents. And that's what I really need to do, is to look into the book and remind myself. I want to say that that side of the family, I know there were the Pokes that were involved as well. And the old ancestral families out here, you know, were the people like the Walkers, the Pokes, the Moores, the Powells, the Stuarts. You know, there were a bunch of them, which once again I think are mentioned in the Brownsburg Museum. And what is interesting to me is people talk as if this whole area began with the Borden grind, but these people were already out here, from my understanding, before Borden even arrived. And in fact, they were a bit huffy about Borden coming in and saying, hey, I've come to claim all these lands, you know, etc. And when there are even stories, which may be apocryphal, that they were sort of run off some of the lands by gunpoint. I don't know if that's true or not.
And the cemetery that you mentioned.
Yes.
Are any of those graves marked? Or
they are marked. They're very badly eroded. You know, they're covered with moss and all that sort of stuff. But one of the things that I used to find very interesting when my mother lived here is that, because this is called Walker lands, and the Walkers were the original settling families in this area, along with the Hayes, hence Walker's Creek and Hayes Creek, is that almost without fail, at least once a year, somebody would arrive here that we had probably never heard of before that claimed they were Walkers. and they would say, oh, I was the descendant of great Aunt Ruby who went to Texas, etc., and we're the Walkers from Missouri, etc., and they always wanted to go up and see the graveyard, which is actually on Rosa McLaughlin's land, but they could walk up there over our hill and see it and try to figure out who was up there. The funniest, we went to really unusual groups. One is that this very nice little Japanese lady arrived one day, married to one of the Walkers from Hawaii, and she sort of bowed to my mother and she said, you don't think you have a Japanese cousin, do you? etc. And then we had these two really quite unusual, very large old ladies who arrived from, I think it was New Mexico or Arizona. And my son, who was quite little at the time, we were visiting, was thrilled by these old ladies because the son of one of them came with them, who told my son that he had seen extraterrestrials in the deserts of Arizona. My son, he'd been pretty bored by them up to that point. He really picked up on that. But the other thing they all wanted to do is out in the hall there, we have an old Jacobean chair. And everybody wanted to have their photographs seated in the John Walker chair because the story was that it was brought over by the original John Walker, the immigrant from Scotland. And it's not particularly attractive, but, you know, it is ancestral, so everybody, I'll show it to you.
Maybe I could take your picture in the Jacobean Walker ancestral chair.
Oh, yeah, why not? And the Walkers, I have been doing a little bit of research into them. There's a book in there, if you think these are big, which is about the size of two Bibles, all about the Walkers. And I don't know how much you want me to go into that, but they were lowland Scots. And they came from Wigtonshire. My parents actually went over to and met some of the Walkers that stayed behind in Scotland, or the family that stayed behind. And one of them was at this time, this was decades ago, was Lord Walker. He was a law lord over there. But anyway, the Walkers had, like many of the Scots, moved from Scotland into Northern Ireland for a generation or so and to become what's now known as the Scots-Irish. Then they came over here at some point in the 1700s. Most of them, I think, came in through Philadelphia, Baltimore, whatever. And of course, when they got there, they found out that much of Pennsylvania had already been settled. So they, like many of the settlers in this area, came down what was then the Valley Pike, I think it was called, and other people had other names for it, but it's basically Route 11. And they came down and filtered into all these lands down here. And of course, the landscape is not unlike parts of Scotland, so they felt very much at home. And the story I was told is that they came in and built a little log structure of some sort across the creek here in order to establish, you know, their claim. And then that old John Walker, when Walker's always referred to as John the immigrant, then went back up to Pennsylvania to get the other members of the family. He died up there, so then the next generation came down here. And if you look at the old maps, you know, there was, you know, a Tom Walker here and a Fred Walker there, you know, whatever, all up and down the place. And there was an old, this I don't think had anything particularly to do with the Walkers, but there was an old wooden fortress down here along Walker's Creek, which was built because they thought there might be Indian raids into this area. And of course, the biggest one that I know of was the Carr's Creek one. Which didn't affect the people right around here, but it was close enough and pretty horrific. Well, a lot of people killed there, so that they had every reason to be a little bit concerned. But
where was the fort?
The fort, we don't know. It was somewhere along Walker's Creek. And we have old diaries here, which go into quite a lot of the Walker history. Many of them are, first of all, incredibly hard to read. And secondly, just go into the minutiae of life, you know, how many hogs we sold or, you know, where we went to market or that sort of stuff. But an interesting thing happened quite a few years ago in that there was a knock on the back door and this guy was standing there who looked like a pirate with a big black mustache. And he said that his name was Bill Gilbert and he was a writer from Time Life Books. And he had been doing a lot of research on a guy called William Rutherford Walker. And he had traced his family back here. He'd never lived back here, but he just wanted to because the way he'd come across him was he was doing a whole series of books on the great frontier heroes, you know, people like Jedediah Smith and that sort of stuff, the Western men, frontier guys. And he kept, in all the footnotes he came across, people were mentioning this guy called Walker. And they were always saying, well, I was then stuck in a snowdrift up in the Rockies, and then Walker came and rescued me, or something like that. So he thought, who is this guy? And he started researching him and found out he was quite a remarkable man. So he would have come from the Walkers that were here, but like a lot of the Walkers, they moved west. And his family went to Kentucky, then they went to Independence, Missouri. And he ended up as a young man, probably just late teenage, as the sheriff of Independence, Missouri. Now, I went to Independence, Missouri for another reason, and I checked this out, and indeed they have records of him there. He then got involved with the Santa Fe Trail. He and his brother Joel started becoming some of the first guides that took people through the mountains into California. There was a story, and I can't authenticate this, but that Joel's wife was the first woman of English stock to have a child in California, as opposed to, people of Spanish or Mexican or whatever background. I think that's probably questionable, but that's one of the things I heard. And the story was that as he would go take people through the passes, people would come to him and say, look, can you guide us through? And one group of people that came through, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Donner Party or not. Well, the Donner Party came and said, guide us through, and it was a winner, and he said, well, we'll have to go up through the mountains, high mountains, and over. And they said, no, we don't want to do it that way. We don't want to get up in those mountains. We want to go through a pass. And he said, the passes are not safe. We're not going to take you that way. If you want my help, you go the route that I choose. Well, they chose not to go with him. They went through the pass, which today is known as the Donner Pass. They got snowed in there. Many of them died, froze to death, and they turned into cannibals. I mean, if I'm not making up the story, it's authenticated historically. But anyway, the most interesting thing about him was that as he traveled around up there in the mountains, he came across this beautiful, spectacular valley, and he recounted that he had seen this, and I think he even wrote about it in a diary, and it turned out to be what is today Yosemite National Park. Now, I didn't believe this story either, even though Bill Gilbert told me that. So I got in touch with the Yosemite National Park public relations man, and I said, what do you know about William Rutherford Walker? And he said, well, we've got a whole bibliography here about him, and we have photographs of him, in a coonskin hat. So I went out there, because my son was, at this point, had decided to go to film school at the University of Southern California. So we went by a sort of circuitous route, went to Los Angeles by way of Yosemite. And I checked it out, and there's a Walker Pass there, there's a plaque. I didn't have time to actually go up on this footpath and see the plaque. But apparently for many years they had attributed this to a band of soldiers being the first ones to see Yosemite, but now apparently they're giving Walker the credit. So out of that book, out of that thing, came Bill's book, which is called Western Man, which is in the Lexington Library, and you can also buy it, etc. And it goes, it does go into a bit of the background here. It starts up, and it refers to the people up and down Walker's Creek as the Creek Nation, as if they were Indian tribes or something, which I find here it is, the Creek Nation. And he goes into the background and where the Walkers came from and all this sort of stuff. It's really quite interesting for somebody that wants to know a little bit about, about the people that came into this area, even though it's just the first few chapters, and the rest, of course, is about their adventures thereafter.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So, this property is called Walker Lands.
That's right.
And did it descend through your family, or was it out of your family?
No, it's never gone out of the family. And the earliest written records I can find, and I'm sure there are others that predate that, is about 1735. Somewhere we do, at one point, they bought some additional land somewhere there is a deed signed by Thomas Jefferson when he was a governor of Virginia, because they at this point had bought some additional acreage. I can't remember what his dates were as the governor of Virginia. But nor do I know exactly how many acres there were that were owned by the Walkers at that point. I mean, Walker Lands itself is probably, I say probably because we just fairly recently sold some acreage here, but it's probably about 550 acres, something like that. And much of it is forest land. And back in the forest land, there were the remains of some old cabins, which some of the walkers had lived in. They're no longer there, you know, because long since, you know, have fallen down. But we own land right up Jump Mountain, and because that is another story, and nobody seems to know the true story of Jump Mountain. But the, of course, the romantic story is that an Indian princess jumped off the top of the mountain when she saw her brave killed in battle down at the base of the mountain somewhere. And the only thing that's, there were two things that are interesting about that. One is she must have had incredibly good eyesight, if that is indeed true. But the other thing is that there is evidence that there were Indian trails that went along these north mountains here and went up onto Jump Mountain, etc. And also, of course, down here at Indian Bottom, there were Indian mounds down there until fairly recent times, when one of the Valentines from the, you know, quite well-known Valentine family in Richmond came up here and dug them up and took them off to Richmond. The Valentine Museum in Richmond is named after that family. And, of course, one of the stories that my mother used to tell is that there was this old Scotsman who was buried standing up on the side of that hill overlooking Indian Bottom because he wanted to have a ringside seat when the Indians rose up on Judgment Day. Now, where these stories kind of came from, I don't know.
Well, I'm so glad you remembered them so you can tell them.
Yeah. But Charlie Valentine was an old friend of mine who came from the Valentine family. And we used to kid him. You know, we say it was all his fault that we didn't have this big tourist attraction down here near Rockbridge Pass because his uncle or whoever it was came and dug up all the mounds, and it's now just a flat field. But otherwise, we'd have people paying money to come see the Indian mounds.
So Walker lands extended all the way up to Jump Mountain.
We still own right up the side of Jump Mountain. Obviously, we don't own it all. There are a number of people. Mm-hmm. There's some national forest land up there, the Jump Mountain Hunt Club, and some of our neighbors own land up there. And it's still predominantly timberland. We exclusively timberland. We do a certain amount of selective timbering up there. But the farm has come down through my family. I'm not sure how many generations now, but certainly the story of how we ended up with it is sort of semi-interesting. My grandmother was the youngest of this big Victorian family that lived out here, and most of them went west.
And what was their name?
Walker.
Okay.
Yeah, and most of them went west, and then there were two of them left behind, a spinster sister and a bachelor uncle. And I never knew them because my grandmother being the youngest of the group, you know, they died up early on.
I think they're the ones that my Aunt Mary called Uncle Tom and Aunt Maggie.
Yeah, that's it. And Aunt Maggie was apparently quite a character.
Or Cousin Tom and Cousin Maggie,
yeah.
I think she said they.
Yeah, well, that would be the case. And and Maggie, they apparently were both real characters. Uncle Tom was apparently quite short and very funny, according to my mother. You know, she said she called him a cute little man, and she said he was very, very funny and very dapper and very lively. And Aunt Maggie was apparently quite, I don't know if she was a large lady, but she was very, she's something that you'd expect to come out of a Victorian novel, you know. And apparently she'd been very in love with the missionary, and he had chosen to marry this pretty, rather fluffy lady and took her off to the Congo or something. And of course she immediately got a fever and died, or fairly shortly afterwards. And Aunt Maggie always could see herself, you see, as a pioneering missionary lady in the Congo, etc. So, and there was a story that Uncle Tom had an unrequited love affair too. But anyway, they lived here together, and I think Aunt Maggie died first. Well, she was a very stubborn woman, and she apparently was sort of ruled the roost as far as the community was concerned. And she everyone was getting into Model T Fords and driving to New Providence on a Sunday. Well, she bought a Model T Ford, she and Uncle Tom, and I think about the first or second time she lost control of it and ran into a pig, and she was so embarrassed after that she refused to drive it again. These, of course, are all stories that my mother told me, so I don't, you know, they might have been elaborated a bit. So she took back to driving a horse and carriage, and she'd drive in the middle of the road, and everybody would be queued up behind her to go to church, you know, because nobody could get around her in their cars. They were all hooting their horns and all that. But anyway, then Uncle Tom was left here by himself after she died, and he became a bit of a recluse, apparently. And he had a very nice black lady called Camelia and her daughter Charlotte, who became my mother's best friend. And they lived in Brownsburg for quite some time, and Harris, that's right. Cornelia Harris and Charlotte Harris, I think was the name. Anyway, I know Cornelia got married in the little church in Brownsburg. But I know Charlotte did, sorry. But anyway, they lived here. And so the farm was going to be left to my grandmother, and she said, oh, she didn't want it because her husband, she lived out in West Virginia, and her husband was not a farm guy, and they'd never be able to run it and all that sort of stuff. So it was put up for auction. And I can remember going to the auction as a tiny little child, which was held over at one of our cousins, was somebody called Mary Brown Anderson, and I think the auction was over at her house. It was in the middle of the Depression. So there was, or at the end of the Depression, I can't remember. I may just remember this, you know, by hearsay rather than in reality. But then my grandmother relented, and she burst into tears and said, oh, we can't let the family home go out of the family. So my parents had to actually intervene and keep it from going out of the family before it was sold. So they had to buy it. It was the middle of the Depression. They didn't have any money, you know. And they were living in Roanoke. My father was a businessman, but, you know, they were a young couple, and, you know. But at that point, this was a true mountain farm, like I think many of the farms out here were. I can remember as a child, we had an ice house over there. We had a creamery, or whatever you called it, down there. There was a, you know, an outdoor toilet. There was a big grape arbor. There was a huge orchard over there. There was an enormous old barn where they used to keep the horses and all that sort of stuff. There was a machine shed, a corn cob place, you know, all that sort of stuff on this ridge all up and down here. And but you couldn't keep these buildings together, because they had wooden shingled roofs. So there were my parents in a smokehouse out in the corner here, and the remains of the old log house that was built before this house. So this house dates from about 1860. I'm not too sure when the old log house would have been built, with its old kitchens that still sits out there in the side yard. So, you know, there was this, here was this, my father, they owned the house in Roanoke. He was working there, and they rented this house out. The Molars lived here. I don't know if you know them. From Rockford Pass. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was Betty and, gosh, I'll remember his name in a minute, Betty Molar. Her daughter was Jean Molar, who was the postmistress at Rockbridge Pass for years and years and years. Betty Jean, I think her name was. So they lived here and farmed the farm, and we lived in Roanoke, and we kept a couple rooms, and we'd come out here and, you know, live. Now, Uncle Tom had never put in running water. He never put in electricity. And so then when my parents, the Molars, you know, my parents decided they wanted to spend more time out here, and the Molars moved down into Rockbridge Pass. And we came out here, and the place was, you know, was in pretty bad condition, not because of them, but just because Uncle Tom had never made any improvements. So my father had to make a decision. Do we fix up the house here and run electricity in, run heating in, run running water in, or do we spend all our money trying to keep up all these outbuildings? And of course the decision was made to focus on the house and the property around the house and whatever. But it was amusing to me, because when they decided to build the Museum of the First American Frontier up in Stanton, they're desperately looking around for a frontier farm, and almost none of them existed. So they had to go out and buy a barn from here and an outdoor Johnny house from someplace else, bring them all together and put them over there, when, you know, in my childhood, these farms around here still had, or many of them still had all of that stuff.
So your grandmother actually grew up in this house?
Oh yeah, she grew up here.
And then she had married and moved away to West Virginia?
Well, before she married my grandfather, who courted her for something like 7 years, she said, I will not marry you unless I have the agreement that I come back home every summer. You know, if we have children, you know, I have to come back home every summer. So my mother tells me that when she was a little girl, they would Montgomery, West Virginia was named, which is not much of a town anymore, but it was my paternal, not my paternal, but my mother's paternal side of the family were Montgomerys, and they were more, you know, Scots that came over in sort of that same wave. And Montgomery, West Virginia was their plantation, and it was called Montgomery's Landing along the Kanawha River there. So my grandfather was one of the Montgomerys. So they met, I think, through, it was something to do with New Providence Church. The pastor of New Providence went out to Montgomery as a pastor. There was some connection there. Anyway, so she would come back on the train as a child with my grandmother, and the train would come into Goshen, and Aunt Maggie would go out in her coach and horses, and or horses and carriage or whatever it was she drove, the wagon, to get them with all the baggage, etc. And she'd come back here and spend the entire summer. And as I say, her best friend was the cook's daughter, Charlotte. And by an amazing coincidence, I think, at the Brownsburg picnic about a couple of days ago, this very attractive gentleman came up to me, and he said, "Do you remember me?" And I didn't. And he said, I was Charlotte's nephew. And he said, "I came out to your house once when I was a young man, and I met you." And he said, "My sister was Charlotte's half-sister, Genevieve. And his wife is now the pastor of the little, African-American church in Brownsburg."
His name is Harry Holtz, I think.
That's it. It was Harry and Conchita. Mm-hmm. Is that her mm-hmm. name? Harry and Conchita Holtz. And it was just amazing, you know, how these things, you know, these family circles or family friends, you know, sort of move back into some sort of focus, you know, decades later. So, so the family, so my mother came out here every summer, and she had, at that time, was mainly, and she absolutely adored Aunt Maggie. And, she, you know, she told all sorts of stories about growing up out here. Mary Lipscomb, you know, tells some of the same stories. Apparently, Aunt Maggie and Uncle Thomas, I said, were great characters, and a lot of the people in the community knew them.
Well, Mary Lipscomb talked about her parents would go with a group of people to Wilson Springs.
Oh, yeah.
And she and my father would stay here
mm-hmm.
with Cousin Maggie and Cousin Tom
yeah.
and Charlotte. And she she adored Charlotte as well. She said Charlotte taught her how to crochet. And
Charlotte was so cute. I mean, she came back here. She and Mother remained friends. Mother died at 97, about 4 years ago. And I can't remember what age Charlotte was when she last came out here, but she was quite up in years. And the two of them sat out in the den out there and told stories about what it was like growing up together out here. And I wished I'd had
Where was the tape recorder that day?
I know. Well, actually, I tried to tape my mother a couple of times, and the tape kept breaking. And Mother wasn't, for some reason, she froze up when she got around the tape recorder. I guess it was because mine was a sort of very incompetent tape recorder. I kept having to rewind, and the tape kept breaking and whatever, but yeah.
Was your mother an only child?
She was, yeah, she was. But she always, I think when she got out here, she probably didn't feel so much that way because there were lots of kiss and kin out here, you mm-hmm. know. She knew a lot of the McLaughlins. They were sort of, they were all distant kin, you know, to one another. And she knew, I guess she was a contemporary of Sam McLaughlin, and Lee, I guess, was much younger, I'm not too sure. But yeah, she used to tell me how she used to go horseback riding with the McLaughlins and all this sort of stuff. And you know, you probably will want to talk to some of them, too, if you haven't already.
I've talked to Sandy, and he talked a lot about the camps.
Yeah.
And Rosa's on our list to interview. I think
uh-huh.
Georgie Young from the Mill
mm-hmm.
is going to be interviewing Rosa.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's something... I'll have to mention this because I'm going to see Georgie probably tomorrow. I think that Rosa is descended from Pocahontas. I'm not sure,
really?
But if that's the case, I mean, she doesn't make a big fuss about it, but I think she is.
Well, and Georgie will absolutely have to ask about that.
Oh, of course, yeah. You know, she has that lovely bone structure, you know, with the high
She's beautiful,
on.
I think.
Yeah. Lovely lady. And I that's a story in the family. Yeah.
And are you an only child as well?
Yeah, I'm an only child too. It seems that my father had, my father grew up in Norfolk, and he's, you know, a Mason, and one of the, I don't mean a Masonic Mason, but one of my great desires is to see, I'm not particularly into genealogy, but the story in the family was that we always were kin to George Mason, you know, the great buddy of George Washington, and they bought the railroads, the Virginia Bill of Rights, and all that sort of stuff. Now, I bought a couple of books about George Mason, but there was some story that we were descended from his brother or something, and I've never had time to go into that. There was so much on the maternal side that we got ensnared with everything. But you know, these family stories are quite fascinating because, for instance, with the Montgomerys, which have no connection out here except to my grandfather, you know, from West Virginia, was a Montgomery. But I was, of all things, at a sheepdog trial, what they call a sheepdog trial, up in New Jersey. And I sort of got out of the car and I thought, why are all these people dressed up in, you know, in kilts and all leaping around out here and, you know, throwing the caper and all this sort of stuff in a field in New Jersey. And they had little tents around, and I went to one of the tents and they said, oh, well, you know, you can check your heritage here, your Scottish heritage. And I said, well, my family, my grandfather, they were Montgomerys. And they said, oh, well, the Montgomerys were a sept of the Argylls, and actually the Campbells. And that's another story. In fact, we found out that one of the Walkers was married to a descendant, the man that should have become the Duke of Argyll. But for some reason, he blotted his copybook and left Scotland and married a Walker. But that's another story anyway. So, but I'll be real brief about this because it has no relationship to this. But we were there, so I said, oh, that's interesting. And they said, well, why don't you join the Montgomery Clan Society? And I said, well, okay, you know, why not? So I joined in Mother's Day and gave it to her as a present to her. And she started getting their newsletters. And in fact, oddly enough, here's one of the newsletters here. And when we started reading it, we found out, we thought the Montgomerys were all this is relevant, Montgomery, it says. We found out that the Montgomerys were actually not originally Scots and Irish and all that. They were Norwegian or Scandinavian rapers and pillagers. They were the Gomeriks, and they set sail on their ships and pillaged and raped along the northern coast of France, and eventually set themselves up a fortress on a hill, and they were known as the Mons Gomeriks, you know, the Gomeriks that live on the hill. And then they became buddies, eventually became, you know, translated into French, and they became the Montgomerys. And they then became buddies, so Norman, one of them, became a buddy of William the Conqueror and came over to England when he conquered England and stayed over there. And there's a Montgomeryshire in Wales. And then they ended up in Scotland, and where there are some Montgomerys up there. And then they went over to Northern Ireland and then came to America. So, you know, you suddenly have all of these Montgomerys cropping up all over the place who think that they are these rather sort of posh Scots, and they actually all went back to a bunch of Viking raiders. So you never know where your people came from.
You have to be careful which roots of the family tree you're tracing.
Oh, yeah.
You have to be prepared for what you find.
Well, in Britain, there's a wonderful TV program called Who Do You Think You Are?
I haven't seen that, no.
Well, I don't know if they brought it over here or not, but people will trace their roots. And quite often, well, they all pretend like they don't know where they came from. The mayor of London, who is a toe-headed, eccentric guy called Boris Johnson, they found out that his grandfather on one side was a Turk who was... ran afoul of Ataturk when Ataturk, you know, took over Turkey, and that he was assassinated. In fact, he was hung by a bunch of thugs or something. And, you know, you have pictures of this guy, you know, with a big black mustache and all, and Boris is, as I say, toe-headed and rather plump and couldn't look more like it, less like it. And on the other side, on his paternal side, I think it was something like the illegitimate child of one of the French kings or something. So I just find
fascinating character.
When you do genealogy in that way, it's fun. But the people that will go endlessly through, you know, a book like this and pull out every this third son of the fifth mother or something, you know, it's just too much.
It gets to be tedious.
Yeah, exactly.
So your mother lived here full time at some point?
No. She did. She spent every summer here, up until, you know, she went off to college, I guess.
Where did she go to college?
She went to Queens College in Charlotte, North Carolina, which was then, I think, a Presbyterian college, Queen Shakora, I think it was called at that point. But then when she and my father got married, his job kept transferring him, and they lived in about six different states. But they always kept a foothold here. And then, of course, when the place was just about to be auctioned off because of my grandmother's refusal to take it on, they then rushed into the fray and kept it from going out of the family and bought it. So then after they retired, they lived, my father was the regional manager, I think, a regional sales manager for Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. And they ended up in Richmond and lived down in the Fan District. They had a very pretty townhouse in the Fan District. But they came out here every weekend. And then they decided that my father took slightly early retirement, and they fixed the place up. And then I was working in Richmond on the Richmond News Leader, which of course no longer exists, but was the evening paper of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. And I used to come out here on weekends and bring all my friends. And I think really the first room here that was actually totally decorated was done by me and a then boyfriend who got dragooned into doing this. He came out for a weekend and ended up on the stepladder painting most of the time.
I'm going to flip the tape over. So we're back on the tape.
Yeah, okay.
So your parents lived in Richmond but came here?
Well, my parents lived in Roanoke. I grew up in Roanoke. And then I ended up at the University of North Carolina. And I knew from her. My mother was always, she was a teacher much of her life, but she always liked to dabble around in writing. And maybe I picked it up from her, I don't know, but I started writing early on. I mean, even when I was in elementary school in Roanoke, a bunch of us put out a little newspaper called the Chatterbox, I can remember, and we all had great fun. Somebody was a film critic and somebody else wrote the other news and whatever. And I guess it got into my blood early on. But I graduated from UNC which had quite a good journalism school, with a BA in journalism, and my first job was on the Richmond News Leader, where they made back then, it wasn't that long ago, they always tried to put lady journalists on the women's pages, you know, to write about flower arranging and weddings and all that. Of course, it's long since changed, but they hired me as a so-called editorial assistant, and I found out I was working, doing more or less the same work as a couple guys that graduated from the same university the same year and were being paid twice as much as me because they were journalists and I was an editorial assistant. So, I mean, that's, we get into the woman's lib thing here, but I sorted that out by freelancing for another newspaper, and I was told I couldn't do that, and I pointed out that I wasn't being paid or hired as a journalist, but as an editorial assistant. Now the newspaper seemed to have this misguided thought that I was a journalist. So anyway, we sorted that out. And I was covering all sorts of different things, medicine, health, welfare. And when I left, I was sort of special features editor. And then I had, while I was living in Richmond, made a lot of friends who were, oddly enough, Europeans. I say oddly enough because you don't think of Richmond, back in those days, Richmond wasn't a particularly cosmopolitan city. So I was going over on my holidays to spend time with friends in Europe and decided that I wanted to keep in journalism, but I wanted to move into a bigger city, and I didn't quite know which city I wanted to go to. So I thought, well, if this is a good time, I'll just take a year out to go to Europe. So I bought a one-way trip ticket and went to Paris, and where I had a boyfriend, which helped, and then lived there for a few months, and then decided to go with another friend to Athens, and lived in Athens for 6 months, and then I thought, I really like living in Europe, this is great, and how can I stay here? My friends were horrified, my parents were horrified, they thought I'd turned into a hippie, so they came over and met me in Paris and tried to persuade me to come back to Virginia. And we compromised by my going to London, or going to England to be more precise, where I had a friend and they thought she was a very sensible lady, would talk some sense.
Stabilizing
influence. In fact, she was more of a hippie than I was. But anyway, so I went over and lived with her in a little village outside of Cambridge. And we lived in a thatched cottage, and I started looking for a job in London. It never occurred to me that I didn't have a work permit. Of course, legally couldn't work. But anyway, I ended up getting a job on a magazine that was a travel magazine that was just starting up, and they wanted someone that knew America well. And I still didn't have a work permit. And then I thought, well, that's got to be top priority. And at that time, Pan Am was the top airline across the Atlantic. And another friend of mine, who was their press officer, was moving back to San Francisco, so his job became vacant, and it came with a work permit, so I applied for the job and got it, and it was probably one of the smartest things I ever did, because at that time, Pan Am was so well regarded, and being in that position, I got to meet all the journalists, and I started, then got a lot of work as a travel writer, eventually, and so I started writing for a lot of magazines, newspapers over there, primarily for the Sunday Telegraph over there, and for some magazines and newspapers back over here. And then I got married to an English photographer that I met through, you know, all of these connections, etc. He'd been married before, so I suddenly became a stepmom. I'm still very close to both of my stepchildren. My stepson lives in Berlin with his German wife and their two little children. My stepdaughter is in London with her two little girls. And then we had a son, and he has followed both routes. His father was a music photographer. He did mainly back when record covers, you know, everything was in vinyl, and books and posters and all this sort of stuff. And he photographed the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and all that stuff early on. So my son now went off to go to film school at the University of Southern California, met his wife out there, who's American. And they shared an interest in music, and he, after about 4 or 5 years in the film industry, got a little bit disillusioned for all sorts of reasons, and his great love was, second love was music, so they launched a music magazine, which has now been running for 5 years. It's indie music, which is not necessarily my type of music, but so they are the joint editors and publishers of the music magazine, and of course his father's interest was music, my interest was journalism. So we all try to keep together, you know, meet up from time to time. Mm-hmm. And we had a great family reunion out here before, a couple of years before my mother died. And, you know, we were all out here at that point.
When did your mother die? 4 years ago?
4 years, 2004, mm-hmm. You know.
Can you tell me a little bit about the Brownsburg Book Club?
Oh, well, Mother, it was actually, even though she had spent so much time out here as a child, when my father announced that he wanted to sell the house in Richmond and move out here permanently, I think it was Mother that had trepidations, because she had gotten, she went as quite an elderly, you know, well, I guess she was in her, what, 70s, 80s, whatever. She went to night school and took courses at the local universities, and she took creative writing courses and all this sort of stuff, and she was very involved with the AAUW there and all that sort of stuff. And she said, well, I'm not sure I can live out in the country, you know. So anyway, she came out here, and I don't know the full story. Georgie can probably tell you better than I can, because she was a member of the book club. But Mother set up, she's credited with being one of the ladies, because she said, well, if I'm going to be out there, I read all the time, I need to talk to people about books. So she set up the book club, and she used to do the reviews for the Lexington paper. You know, say what the ladies of Rockbridge County were reading this week. And it was a rather novel book club, because unlike most book clubs where everybody reads the same book, everybody read whatever they wanted to. And I went several times to the book club, and it was an absolute hoot, because, you know, one person would be reading Barbara Kingsolver or whatever her name is, and somebody else would be reading the annotated version of Winnie the Pooh. And Mother took this book in that my stepson gave her on about how Mexico City's environmental problems. And it was so much fun, it really was. And most of the people there were much, much younger than Mother. And you know a lot of them. You know, Betsy Anderson was one of them, and Georgie Young, and gosh, I'm trying to think. Several ladies that have now moved out of the community.
I think Rosa was a member.
Rosa was, but Rosa didn't come that often. She was just so involved with the camp, mm-hmm. but she was technically a member too, yeah. And Nancy McLaughlin, you know, who's now died quite a few years ago, but who lived in Brownsboro, was, you know, certainly one of the members. And Mary Frances Davis, did you know
mm-hmm,
her?
Mm-hmm.
Who doesn't live here anymore.
Right.
But there were a whole bunch of people that were members. And they used to have quite a good time. And it still continues.
I always enjoyed reading your mother's column in the paper.
Yeah.
I wish we had all of those for the museum, because they were just wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wonder, I bet you we've got copies of them here somewhere. I have to look.
Well, if you ever come across those,
yeah, I will.
They would be wonderful.
Yeah, I will.
Because they really, I think, told a story of what people were doing, what they were reading.
Oh, yeah. And I thought it was so much, you know, some of my British friends who go to book clubs would say, you know, they all read different books. How did that operate? And I said, well, trust me, it worked. And I said, I think I prefer that. Because otherwise what happens is, you know, a person, it becomes very academic. A person, they all read the same book, and then they all get into an argument about
it. Or they don't
book.
Read it.
Or they don't.
Because it's something they don't want to read.
That's
so.
Right. That's right. So this was much more fun.
Mm-hmm. So you spent a lot of time growing up. You were in Roanoke in Richmond, but spent time here.
Oh, yeah. I came out here. But at that time, I found I was very lonely out here, because I was an only child. And the people that were geographically closest to me, you know, were the McLaughlins, but Rose's kids. But they were all much younger than I was. And that didn't make an awful lot of difference, but they were. And one summer, I taught over at the camp over there. You know, I was one of the counselors there. So I got to know, you know, some of those folks pretty well. Some of them have moved back now. You know, Nellie McLaughlin has now moved back. She and I were a counselor, and her big sister, and Sam McLaughlin's daughter, who lived in Richmond, and somebody called Sarah Swan, who now I understand lives out here. In fact, I think I'd have him going to a dinner party on Saturday night. She's going to be there. So I was out here a lot. But the thing was that back then, for the most part, it was the local people who were obviously very much part of the community and were in farming and whatever. Then there were the summer people who were either involved with the camp or who came out and lived along the river down at Rockbridge Baths or something like that, came up from Richmond to get away from the heat. And, you know, for a sort of kid on their own, you didn't sort of fit into any of these communities unless you did, as I eventually did, work down, you know, at the camp. Because, of course, when I was a child out here, the camp didn't have girls. It was a boys' camp. And it was only when I was at college age that it started taking girls, and that's why I was a counselor there, either the first or the second year that we were there. But it's changed out here, and I think it's changed. I think it's changed for the best, because there's so many people that have come in from all over the place as permanent residents, which means that you have people that you can have quite a lot of in common with, because you may have at some point lived in the same place, and you've traveled a bit, and you just get to know each other that way. Whereas before, I thought, well, if I didn't belong to the 4-H club or something, I'm not being snide. Mm-hmm. It's just simply that matter. I'd come out here and the kids didn't know who I was, and I didn't have, I wasn't going to school out here. I wasn't, I didn't know any of them. They didn't know me. So now it's great. I probably have as many friends out here as I have in London. And so I feel right at home when I go out.
Well, did your family, the Mollers, lived here, but you stay here too?
What happened was that we kept, we didn't live here. We just mm-hmm. come out in the summer. We come out maybe a few times in the summer and camp out, in effect, upstairs, and we had two or three rooms that we kept for ourselves. And the Mollers had, they had their kids live down here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they had one of the rooms upstairs or something like that. So it worked out.
And so you ate separately and did everything?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes we'd eat with Jake Moller, that was his name, with Betty and Jake and the kids. And I can remember how atmospheric it was coming out here, because I was out here 1 year at harvest time. And all the guys came around with the old steam reapers. Do you remember?
The threshing machines,
yes. Machine. Mm-hmm. And I remember that they'd all come around in the bib, all girls, and they'd get out there, I guess, early in the morning, and then at lunchtime, they'd all come and they'd sit along the big back porch here. And Betty Moller and some of the other wives would spread out tables, and they'd have all sorts of, good food. I mean, rice pudding, corn pudding, and apple pies, and goodness knows what. And they'd put sort of, what did they call it, cheesecloth or something over it, and then the guys would go back out in the field. And then at nighttime, they'd all, and they'd take a little nap. They'd all sleep in those old rocking chairs uh-huh. along the back. And then at night, they'd come back and finish the threshing in the evening when it got cool again. And then they'd bring, all the food would still be there, and it would be cold then, but everyone would have cold corn mm-hmm. ready or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that. And they had in the dining room here, which of course is now quite formal, there was a huge old pot-bellied stove that jutted out into the room there. I remember going back into the kitchen there. Mother says when she was a child, the kitchen there, which is where the den is now, was filled with smoke and, because they had a huge old fireplace, not fireplace, but I think another old pot-bellied stove in there, etc. And you read by kerosene lamps, and there was the pump out in the, which is still, the old sister's still sort of stuck jumping out of the little patio out there now. You pump up your water. Mother always said, we had to wash our hair by rainwater, because it was so much better for your hair and all that stuff. Yeah, I remember all
so
that.
So you remember before the plumbing was in the house?
Oh, yeah. The plumbing wasn't put in until I was in probably in late high school or early college, early university. Because, my parents didn't move out here until they retired. And it wasn't until they retired that all of this stuff work was done. So the place was always a work in progress. And then when mother got much older, and my father died about 28 years before my mother did, mm-hmm. And she was out here amazingly, on her own, and coped surprisingly well, I thought.
She live here by herself, or did
she
have someone?
Alice Carter, Alice and Lewis
right.
Carter?
Mm-hmm.
Alice used to come out here during the weekdays, and she'd come out here for a few hours every day, and she would, look after mother. And when mother got to be older and couldn't drive, Alice would, go get her groceries for her and whatever. Mother didn't learn to drive until she was probably about, late 50s or early 60s or something. And she would never, wouldn't even drive into Lexington. She'd drive into Fairfield, was a big deal, or she'd drive to New Providence. Otherwise, somebody, had to drive her, because she, the traffic congestion in Lexington, she'd say. And here I'm batting around in London.
In London.
Not having much sympathy.
How about the Civil War? Did your Did Maggie and Tom have any stories of...
Well, of course, they were dead by the time I came along. Mm-hmm. But Mother said that Robert E. Lee used to come out here on Traveler and visit the house. And I don't know which of my ancestors would have been around here at that point, but that's what Mother said. And outside of that, I don't really know. I don't think the Civil War had a big impact. I'm sure that some of the men in the family would have been in the Civil War. But the ones that, you know, the pictures that we have in there, those pictures were, judging from the way they were dressed, they must have been, you know, post-Civil War, 1890s mm-hmm. or whatever. You know. And sadly, I don't know much about the family before they moved into this house. You know, the 18, which would have been 1860. I don't know anything about the old log house. I'm sure if I did quite a lot of, you know, delving, I would find out more about it. And I know very little about the family before that generation, except what I've told you.
I think we've covered most of my topics. Would, do you mind if I get a little personal information? Could you tell me when and where you were born?
Now, do I have to tell you what year I was born?
Yeah, you don't have to if you don't want to.
Well, I was born in Louisville, Kentucky, because at the time my parents were living out there. And let's just say I'm older than 60 years old.
Okay, good enough. And could I get your mailing address in London?
Yeah, it's 55 Hereford Road, that's H-E-R-E-F-O-R-D Road, and it's London. W for Walter, 2, 5,
W? 2. W2?
2 for
okay.
Walter, 5, BB for boy, boy.
W2, 5, BB.
BB for my boy, boy.
And one other thing, I wanted to ask you, the hand-painted china that you've loaned to the museum.
Uh-huh.
Margaret Scavera mentioned that you said some of the Morris ladies.
Yeah, they did. Now, I know relatively little about that. Except mother told me that the family's, as I believe Mary Lipscomb has told you, used to go up to Wilson Springs. And she said that these ladies, and I think there were maybe more than one, mm-hmm. Miss Morris, that used to come there and they painted the china. And that, you know, the family bought it. Now, I know that Doc Martin has some of it too, and I'd be quite interested to find out if she knows more about this china.
Well, what I think I know about it is the three ladies, the one who painted most of the china, I think, was named Minnie Rebecca mm-hmm. Morris.
Yeah.
And they
lived. My mother's referred to as Miss Minnie Morris.
Mm-hmm. They lived where Dick and Betsy Anderson live now.
Oh, how interesting.
And their sister in law was a minister.
Uh huh.
And she had built in the side yard there a little church that people call the Friends Lighthouse Mission Church. And I think it was some sort of evangelical Quakers.
Oh,
and she had a little log building in the back that she ran a little public hospital, mm-hmm. like a two-bed hospital that she named William Penn.
Yeah.
And she I think, was a fascinating person. And then these three women who evidently painted the china were her sisters-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
And I've looked at some of the deeds, and the deeds say that the sisters-in-law were supposed to be allowed to live in the house mm-hmm. as long as they were alive.
Oh,
and she deeded part of her property, an acre or so, to the Quaker Church.
Mm. Well, I think the china is lovely.
It's
beautiful.
We've
got more in there, which I'll show you before you leave. I think they've got the best pieces. But it was interesting because of the various things that, you know, I thought they might want to take. It never occurred to me that that would be of interest to them, but I didn't know that there was this local connection that there was. But apparently, it was, I mean, the whole Wilson Springs thing would be interesting. Now, who is it that lives up in the old Wilson house? It's not Katie Letchelaar. Who's that guy that is a local historian? Because that would be interesting to talk to someone about.
Well, was it Roysterlaw?
Roysterlaw.
Who's no longer living.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that. When did he die?
He died a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And he had been married to Katie Letcher-Lyle.
Oh, okay. Because, you know, those people would be of interest, too. Have you talked to, I had several things to ask you, actually, about on this thing, but have you talked to any of the people in the black community?
Mm-hmm.
What about, is it Betty that you talked to?
We've interviewed Betty, and Lewis Carter and Alice are on my list.
Oh,
we've
good.
Talked
yeah.
to, was Alice a Stewart?
I don't know.
I've talked to Sammy Stewart. I've talked to Virginia Franklin. There was a very well-known black man named Zach Franklin who had a big family.
Yeah.
He had 10 children, and they lived out at Castle Carberry, which is the...
Oh, I know where that is. Now, is that still owned by Nan?
It is. Nell.
Nell.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, you know, I've totally lost contact with her.
We've been trying to get in touch with Nell to see if she has anything for the museum, but she's never gotten back in touch.
Nell lives in San Antonio, and I've lost touch with her because, you know, all those, you know, McLaughlins have, that family has more or less died out now. And of course, what's a shame in many ways is that Nancy McLaughlin died when she did.
This is the Wade family.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And her name is Nell Marchant.
Yeah.
Nell Marchant.
Well, see, Nell, for a while, she and her husband, who is a orthopedic surgeon, lived in England.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, and because he was sent over there by, apparently, when he went to medical school or something like that, part of the deal was that he had to serve overseas, you know, with the forces. And he was had a pretty soft assignment. They were up somewhere in Norfolk, I think. So we got to know each other at that time. And she came down and visited me in London, and I went up and visited her, because we had never really known each other. I knew her mother, of course, because her mother was the sister that Eleanor was the younger sister of Jen.
Right.
Wade Heffelfinger. Because Nancy McLaughlin, that was another branch of the McLaughlin family, who lived in Brownsburg, and she accumulated everything. When they had the sale after she died, and Bill remarried another Nancy, and now he's died, but she owned something like 4 buildings, and, well, you know this, in Brownsburg, and it was just full of everything that she had collected, and some of that stuff probably would have been good for the museum. Yeah,
absolutely. I think she had a wonderful book collection.
Oh, she did, yeah. But I know there are a couple of questions I wanted to ask you. One is, when all this is available, I mean, when will it be available? Because I'd love to listen to some of these tapes.
What we're doing is, what will happen with your interview is we'll have it transcribed, and you will get a copy and you'll be able to edit.
Oh, that's great.
And then the transcriptions that we've already finished are in the museum now.
Uh-huh.
And then we'll at some point have digital audio files of all these interviews in the museum so that people
great.
Can listen to them.
I'm sorry, mine is very long-winded, but maybe you could break it into different things, the Walkers and the Mary Walker.
At some point, we'd like to do CDs, maybe based on subject matter, just voices of different people that have done oral histories talking about a particular subject, like World War II or the Depression or their family history.
Well, one of the things I was curious about, and it touched on in the museum, I'd always heard the story about the Walker and whatever it was, shoot up in Brownsburg. And I know Nancy McLaughlin, who had a wild sense of humor, thought this was so funny, you know, that they're shooting each other in the courtroom.
Yeah.
But what was that all about?
Well, Dr. Walker,
Are you sure
it was
you
the Walkers.
Like a little nibble of these? They're rather nice, actually.
I will have a little.
Yeah.
Hold on.
Thank you. You will forgive me. What happened to the other?
Doctor,
please forgive me. That's a slightly
Walker and his wife lived in Brownsburg. I think the Millers may have lived out at Bellevue.
Uh-huh.
And evidently there was some. Dr. Walker thought that Mr. Miller had said something inappropriate to his wife or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they go to court over it, and then
just tried to phone me. Did you? It's all because our phone it was not mine. It might be Rose's.
And so the, I guess, I can't remember who shot who first.
Mm-hmm.
I believe Mr. Miller may have shot Dr. Walker, and Dr. Walker's wife ended up being shot, and then I think Dr. Walker shot Mr. Miller, and then Doctor's wife.
Then
the Miller boys
mm-hmm.
shot Dr. Walker, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the Miller boys I'm not sure what happened. We have in the museum, though, the document with their original signatures where they've hired an attorney to represent them. I think the five of these brothers went together, paid $1,000 to hire an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was the big event of the 19th century.
Apparently it was.
But I don't really know the whole story.
And the history of the little church, the little African-American church, is interesting, too.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. We'd like to get more information from the black community from the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we move into the 20th century,
we'll
probably have more from the black community.
Well, see, I don't know how long they were out there. You know, how long most of the black community had been around.
Well, I guess there were slaves on the farms around, and then after the Civil War,
mm-hmm.
I think most of the black people stayed on the farms and
mm-hmm.
worked for pay then.
Well, I noticed that there were, when they have a list, I think, in the museum, of the various people that were connected with the church. I think A. Carter was mentioned mm-hmm. there, so I wonder if it was one of Lewis's ancestors or not.
Probably so.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of these farms had black tenant farmers on them who did the work and knew
mm-hmm.
the farming.
Mm-hmm.
They were the ones who knew how to farm and knew how to do everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the farms, well, our farm had, when my grandfather bought our farm, there was a man named William Halliburton
mm-hmm.
who had worked there, who
yeah.
stayed on to work for my grandfather and taught my grandfather a lot about farming. And
mm-hmm.
this Zach Franklin, I think, taught the Wade family about farming.
That's interesting. You know, in the Walker House in Lexington, apparently that was a black man. I don't know what his background was, but I would say he was probably one of our relatives.
I think, unless you have more stories, I think I've covered.
No, I probably do, but I think nothing that's particularly relevant to what you're working on. What is, just out of curiosity, what is the most interesting thing that you've sort of come across so far in doing this? Because it must have been some really...
I've always been really interested in the Depression era.
Mm-hmm.
And what's fascinated me so much is people will say, we didn't really know. We were sort of poor to start with, and we were farmers, and we raised... There are subsistence farmers and general farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't a lot to start with, and
mm-hmm.
they didn't know any different, really,
yeah.
during the Depression. But it seemed like everyone worked together, and if some people didn't have anything, their neighbors
mm-hmm.
gave them food, and it seemed like such a strong community where people were
mm-hmm.
working together to get by. But
well, you know, that's interesting to me, because you know the little log cabin down here, which I restored, when Mother and I first went into estate planning, she said, well, you know, I can give you all some money. I said, no, don't do that. Give us some land. And she said, well, what do you want? And I said, well, that little corner down there, because at that point, that cabin was derelict. I mean, it was a dump. It was just, you know, old boards hanging off the front of it. We didn't even know if it was a log cabin or what was underneath it. It was just an old run-down building. And she said, well, I don't know what you want at that point. And I said, well, I just want to do something with it. And much to my surprise, when we had it evaluated, because, you know, you can leave, I don't know, it's going up now, I suppose, but what is it, $10,000 a year, in furniture or cash or whatever to your family without people being taxed. So I thought, well, that'll be quite a chunk of land. And no, it wasn't, because they said, well, it's an ideal building site. And I said, well, there's already a building on it. And the appraiser said, well, get rid of that old dump, But he said, you only get 2.4 acres for your $10,000. And this was about 10 years ago, and I said, you must be crazy. I said, but land out here is not worth very much. And he said, but because it's this little knoll, and it's close to the road, and easy access and all that, it's a prime building site. So anyway, I then took it upon myself to I had to run electricity in there, water in there. Luckily, we got a spring right across the road, on the other side of Jump Mountain Road. I had to have all the logs rechanked, had to have the foundations redone, and luckily the roof was always good on it. Otherwise it would have, been totally unusable. But I found out there was a family with something like 9 children that had lived in there. Up until certainly the Depression period and on beyond. And, you know, I think, how on earth, you know, I've rented out now to one very nice lady. By the way, she's leaving, so I mentioned this to you because the way I've rented it out so far, and with one or two exceptions, very successfully, to very nice people, is quite often it's people moving into the community, like the Zimmermans.
Right. When I first met them, they were living there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, at the end of September, Becky Marks, who's been living there, is moving in with her boyfriend, so I've got to find a new tenant. But the point is, 9 people living in there, in a place that's not suitable for more than 2 people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way people live.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember, too, even when I came out here as a child, the place felt depressed. You know, there were so many unpainted buildings and old rusty roofs and, you know, rusty cars in people's front yards and all that. I mean, that's obviously just changed totally now. Or for the most part, it's changed anyway.
But it's just, you're right, so many interesting people have moved into this area, and it's just such a different place than when we were growing up.
Yeah. Well, how did you, I mean, because you went to school here, so you knew people here, which I just didn't.
No, I grew up here, went to college, then moved to Northern Virginia and worked for the government for 30 years.
Uh-huh.
And loved Northern Virginia, loved Washington while I was there, but then as I got closer and closer to retirement, I knew we really wanted to be back here.
Yeah. Well, it really is a nice community, and I think what makes a lot of difference is the fact that Lexington is a university town, because it's, you know, brings so many interesting people together, and they retire from Washington Lee or whatever and want to stay in. One person that I want to look up if I have time while I'm out here is Mary Stuart Gillen. I've always been fond of her, and she was so sweet when my mother died. She came, I wasn't at home at the time, but she came up here, and she wasn't a close friend of my mother, she knew her, but, you know, with this, all these home-baked cookies and everything like that, and left them out on the, you know, the side porch there. But she's a nice lady, and I know she's gone through a rough time because of her husband. And I'd hope to get to know her daughter, but I understand their daughter who lives in Brownsburg is a little standoffish.
She is out of town a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Catherine works down at Fort Monroe a lot.
Oh. What does she do?
She is working on a project to transfer it from a military institution back to the state.
Mm-hmm.
She's Governor Kane's representative
on
the project. She was a college friend of Governor Kane.
All right. Now, do you know, this is a stupid question, but I don't know who my senator is or my house, you know, because I vote out here. Do you know who our senator is out here?
You have Mark Warner and Jim Webb.
Okay, I'm going to write that down, and I'll tell you why. I don't know whether you're a Democrat or Republican, but I'm a member of Democrats Abroad. And
they're both Democrats.
Yeah. And there's something I want to say to these guys. So, this is me switching into my British mode here, but it's irritating me immensely at some of the stuff. I mean, I'm not sure that Obama's health plan is the right health plan for America, but that's what infuriates me is that this British twerp has been quoted over here as a great authority on the healthcare situation in Britain, and he's been bad-mouthing it on television and all this stuff. He's what they call an MEP, a member of the European Parliament. And he's almost totally unknown in Britain. Nobody heard about him until this big row came up. And he's gone on about how we have such terrible health care in Britain and how America wouldn't possibly want to go down this route or have anything that smacks of any sort of communistic or whatever he called it, you know, health care plan. And I found, and all the Americans who live, well, most Americans who live in Europe are in Britain, are incensed by this, because one, they don't know who the hell this man is. They know who he is, but he's a twerp. And secondly, what he's saying is not representative of the situation there. You know, because he's saying something about old people just left to die and all this sort of stuff. And we have a, what's he called it, a death lottery, so that when people reach a certain age, you know, the National Health Service just writes them off. I mean, it's just incensed me because, okay, make your decision whether you don't like or do like, you know, Obama's plan, but or come up with a better one, which is probably the solution. But, you know, don't use it on false pretexts. I mean, I have my son on National Health in Britain. I've, you know, been looked after by National Health the entire time I was there. I have much older friends who've had hip operations. I had an American friend over who came over there, and he had an emergency problem. I whisked him off to the hospital. He was had an operation within 5 hours. You know, it was an emergency, and I knew it was. Nobody said, how are you going to pay for this, you know, whatever, on the spot. You have to queue up and fill out papers and all that. In fact, the nurse was incensed when I said, he has to do this. And she said, listen, if this guy's got problems, we're going to get him in there and sort it out. You can fill out the papers later. Whereas over here, I had an accident about 2 months ago in California. I was riding a bike, which I shouldn't have been doing, down a mountainside, not a mountain bike, just a regular bike. I had an accident. I injured this arm, injured this leg, injured this face, knocked out my 3 front teeth, etc. Went into the emergency ward because my friend was there. And it wasn't a big deal. It was about $600. Medicare won't pick up the tab, even though I paid into Medicare, you know, all my life. I mean, you know, I've worked over here for many years, and when I was over there, I paid into it, so I had Medicare coverage. They won't give me any reason why. My daughter-in-law had an emergency appendectomy out in California, and the bill was, she was in, I think, for maybe a day and a half, 2 days maybe, $43,000. And she, because they're, you know, a young married couple, and they are self-employed, they have health insurance, but they have a big premium, you know, big deductible.
A big deductible.
Well, finally, and the reason why the bill was so big is because the doctor that performed the emergency operation wasn't on their list of authorized people, even though it was in the unauthorized hospital. And she was under an anesthetic, so she didn't know who the guy was, you know. And she eventually, because Wendy's very clever, she cut the bill down to, you know, just maybe $3,000 or $4,000. But it's this type of thing that just, you know, when they go on and on about how we're a bunch of commies over there who, you know, are trying to force this dreadful program down the throats of the Americans, it just really upsets me. And I think that someone who's actually benefited from the program.
Oh, I think you should write.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm going to write these guys down and find out how to find their addresses. I'm sorry to get on my high horse about it, but it really upsets me. I mean, I think probably what they should come up with is a program that's closer to maybe the French system, the Dutch system, the Canadian system. And we do have our problems in England, but at least people are taken care of, you know. I had to pay $200 on the spot, you know, before they would even see me when I went to the emergency ward out in California. So it's, sorry.
Jim Webb.
And
Mark Warner.
Yeah, Mark's been around for a long time.
He was governor.
He was governor, wasn't he? And they're both
senators. Mm-hmm. They're Democrats.
Okay. What about the House of Representatives? I can't think who it is.
Give me a minute and I'll think of it.
Okay. It's no big deal. I just, because I sent, when I was in the library today, I sent off an email to the guy who was, who's head of the Democrats board, and I said, you sent me an email saying, you know, could we please try to put the picture straight with our congressman or whatever. And
his name is Bob Goodlatte.
Oh, yeah, now he's a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I've heard good things about him. Is he good? Or?
He's moderate. Mm-hmm. He's not a...
Is it G-O-O-D-L-A?
L-A-T-T-E.
Yeah. Well, now tell me, are you doing any work out here now, or do you...
I work with my husband in our vineyard.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And I work one day a week at Rockbridge Winery in the tasting room. I pour wine in the tasting room.
Uh-huh.
And then I volunteer at the Stonewall Jackson
yeah.
House.
Uh-huh.
I've enjoyed working on this little museum project.
Is, what's her name, still there? The girl who's...
Michael Lynn.
Michael.
Mm-hmm. She's still the executive director.
Yeah, uh-huh. I've known Michael for years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's been out here before. And she was a great friend of Martha Doss, who used to be the head of the tourist board in, what, I think it was Martha Doss, head of the tourist board, but she left, I think.
I don't know her.
I think she retired mm-hmm. 8 years ago or something like that.
Well, do you have any more Brownsburg stories to share with me?
No,
any more?
I probably do, but I can't think of them.
You think about it, and if you'd like me to come back sometime with the tape recorder, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.